Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
There but for the grace of God go I. But what about there but for the preparedness of the energy grid go I? Maybe actually that's the question that should be on our lips, or the thought we should be thinking about here in New England after watching this kind of slow-moving horror story of frozen pipes, power outages unfold in Texas last week. The Lone Star State is a long way from here, but so many of us did pay attention. This pandemic has given us the sense that other people's experiences can be our own. Maybe gives us a little more empathy, a little more solidarity. It may be warmer in Dallas today than last week, but the questions linger, especially about what it means for us here. What are your questions? What do you want to understand about what happened to the power grid in Texas and what it could mean for New England and how solid we are here? We can talk about the role state governments play. We can talk about energy policy. Call with your thoughts and questions. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now are Dan Dolan, who is president of the New England Power Grid Association, and Robert Stoner, who is deputy director of the MIT Energy Initiative. He's also faculty co-director of that initiative's Low Carbon Energy Center for Electric Power Systems and a member and secretary of the Global Commission to End Energy Poverty. Dan and Robert, I want to welcome you. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thanks very
much. So Dan, I'll start with you. In a nutshell, what went wrong in Texas?
The basic answer is that they had an extraordinarily unusual climate and weather event. For lack of a better word, they had a real winter, the type that we're so often used to here, and it caused an extraordinary reaction across the energy infrastructure supply chain and led to a crisis. But at bottom, this was a 1 in 50, 1 in 100 year type of event that now we're going to be spending a lot of time learning the lessons from.
So, Robert, I hear Dan on the 1 in 50, 1 in 100, but I also find myself thinking we've all gotten pretty used to the fact that these 100-year events seem to be coming every other year. So where was the policy failure in making sure a state is ready for that 1 in 100-year event when it comes? I mean, sooner or later, it's coming.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, this is the second 1 in 100-year event of a very similar nature Texas has had in the last decade. And so, you know, the bottom line is these things are becoming less predictable. Extreme events are becoming predictably more prevalent, and we'll see it again. So what did they do wrong? Well, Texas has long had a history of isolating itself electrically from the rest of the United States system. And that is a source of pride to them and a source of independence and a feeling of independence. Ultimately, it's political. But it's a mistake because it isolates them from potential sources of supply in times exactly like this, when local supply dries up for whatever reason. And so that was a serious mistake. But other things happened as well. You know, when they had their 2011 incident, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission audited the situation and concluded that there were a lot of measures that really needed to be taken. Heating tapes could have been applied to various pipes and sensors that could have at least mitigated the performance failures they had in some of their thermal plants. But they didn't mandate that those changes must be made. They rather mandated that winter preparedness plans should be submitted every year by power station operators, but they gave them the liberty to implement or not implement these mitigative measures.
So you had a plan for it, but didn't have to actually do anything about it, Robert. Is that what you're saying?
Right. You didn't have to make the investment. The idea was that the wholesale market would respond in times of crisis and increase prices dramatically and thereby reduce demand and keep demand and supply matched. And that works when you're in a sort of quasi-equilibrium situation and when you have the flexibility to react. But in this case, they went in one direction and they just kept on losing both initially power stations and transmission lines, and then even the ability to produce and move gas within the system. which is, you know, truly extraordinarily unlikely and unfortunate.
1-800-423-8255 to join this conversation. Add your questions about the New England energy grid, what happened in Texas, you know, your thoughts on whether you feel energy secure. We've got Sophie on the line from Newton. Sophie, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm calling because I had listened earlier today on the program about a family who received a bill for over $10,000, and that's what they had to pay for their electricity based on the type of program they were on. Is this something that could happen to us here, residents in Massachusetts, during a crisis? And I'm happy to take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening, Sophie. I'm sure that's one of the other great shows on WBUR today. And Dan, I mean, it's a legitimate question. Are consumers here safe from the kinds of price spikes that come from the demand pricing Robert was just talking about that exists down in Texas?
Yeah, and there's really two components to that. On the one hand, on the wholesale side of the ledger, and that's the price of electricity coming out of a power plant sold across New England. The prices in New England are far lower than what they are in Texas, in large part because we don't depend on the real-time energy market to drive reliability. We use a three-year forward market for that, and so we have far less variability and volatility in pricing.
Stop you there for a second, Dan. I'm sorry, because I think a three-year forward market is not common parlance. Do you mean that we have essentially reserves that protect us for a three-year cushion?
So our reliability market is something called the forward capacity market, and it's one auction held every year for a commitment to be online 3 years into the future. In Texas, their market is in real time. And because of that, prices can rise very, very high to get a response. The second component to this is then also the programs available for an individual homeowner or consumer. And in Texas, there is a small group of people who have direct exposure to that volatile wholesale market. We do not see those types of products or that level of volatility here in New England.
So what would then, and Robert, maybe you want to answer this, maybe Dan, whoever feels like they can take it. I mean, obviously, that sounds better. So what would behoove a state to do the other thing, right? And be this vulnerable since you got families. I mean, sooner or later, you have to have electricity. I understand people might reduce their demand, but they can't when they're freezing. So what would behoove a state to do that?
Well, you're absolutely right. These are called variable rate plans, and a number of them exist in Texas, and they expose you directly to wholesale costs. And that you're quite right in saying that some people were getting bills of $10,000 or more for electricity in a month. It sounds impossible. So what would behoove a state to allow that? Well, it makes electricity much cheaper in times when there's ample supply. And so it's a way to benefit from those low prices if you're a consumer. And that's very attractive, unfortunately, in many cases, to the very people who shouldn't be playing around with volatile electricity prices. And that's poor people. Because when you get a check, when you get a bill for $10,000 once and you're making $300,000 or $400,000 a year, well, you grumble and you complain and you swear you'll never do it again, but you survive. When you're making $25,000 a year and you get a $10,000 electricity bill, it's a different thing. And when the temperature stays cold and you have to keep running the electricity, it's a desperate situation. So what would behoove a state to do that? I think a disregard for the risks that the general population faces, but in particular, the risks that poor people face in being exposed to such plans.
Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255 to ask your question or share your thoughts on this. A real sense of just energy vulnerability for people. We've got Catherine on the line from Cambridge. Catherine, what's on your mind?
I'm wondering, in the aftermath of the energy crisis in Texas, what this means for green power and the future of climate thinking, forward-thinking energy. A lot was made of the governor's remarks about falsely blaming wind power in Texas. So I'm wondering what the actual factual takeaways are on green power.
Thanks for that, Catherine. And I do understand that in Texas, actually wind, which was a big area of criticism coming from the Texas governor, actually only makes up about 10% of the supply there. Dan, why don't I start with you? What is the conversation on green energy and renewables now? And how real was what appeared to be largely Republican claims in Texas, that that was the problem here? How real was that?
I think there's criticism to be had across the board from what we saw. As I mentioned earlier, this really did impact the entire energy supply chain. This is not a failure of wind. This is not a failure of gas plants. This is a combination of a cascading event and an extraordinary weather situation. Looking forward, I don't think this is going to have any material impact to the continued march forward on the proliferation and development of new clean energy resources. And if anything, I think it underscores the need to address the climate responsibilities that we have, that New England has been a leader on, and continue the march forward while coupling it with the bedrock principle of needing to maintain reliability, particularly as we look to accelerate electrification in places like transportation and otherwise.
And Robert Sinner, I'll ask you to add to that, and maybe with the extra eye towards environmental justice, right? You were just talking about energy poverty. So maybe you can add that layer.
Sure. You know, a study was done a number of years ago, I think 2 years ago, in New England specifically, and it concluded that the increase in renewable energy in New England had actually improved the resiliency of our system by reducing our exposure to fuel shortages, which is kind of interesting. And you'd like to say, well, oh, that's great. Renewable energy is always going to make us more resilient. Of course, that isn't true. And so your risks shift over time. And you know, when we go to a fully renewable system and are reliant on the wind and the sun blowing or shining all the time, or batteries backing us up, we expose ourselves to different sorts of risks. And so that's something we need to be mindful of and constantly assessing the risks that we're exposed to and developing appropriate mitigation strategies. You can keep adding cost. And I talked about the choice that generators were given in Texas about adding cost to their plants by introducing mitigative technologies like heating strips. There comes a point when you can't mitigate every risk to 100%. You're always exposed. And you know, in societies like ours that are rich and have the ability to protect one another, you need to think about your social safety net and examine in advance the vulnerabilities that you have within the population in the event of a failure that you really just can't prevent. And I worry that in Texas, you know, you see, what is it, almost 40 deaths. Were they preventable? Is a lot of the suffering that's going on preventable? You see people relying on charity rather than government programs. Charity is wonderful, but should we be doing better than that? Can we be doing better than that? I'd note that in New England, we spend twice as much on social services than they spend in Texas. And so you can feel good about living in New England, I guess.
Let's take one more call here. We've got Megan from Watertown. Megan, briefly, what's on your mind?
It sounds like just another example of a company being reactive and not proactive and the consumer paying for it in more ways than one.
Well, thanks for that, Megan. And Dan, you know, I don't fully understand the intricacies of what was private versus government in Texas, but this idea of what needs to be done proactively now in our last minute or two, what are the proactive policies you're favoring in New England after watching what unfolded in Texas?
Yeah, to me, it all comes down to how do we maintain the three-legged stool of energy policy right now, which is decarbonization, meeting our climate mandates, preserving and ensuring reliability, particularly as we use electricity more and more, and then cost competitiveness, making sure that the consumer does pay as competitive and affordable a price as possible. It's a tricky dance. Every piece has to fit together. We can't let one get out in front of the other. And that, to me, is where the conversation needs to occur with policymakers, with industry, and with the public.
And Robert Stoner, let me invite you to answer the same question. Either react to Dan or build on that.
Well, you know, electricity systems work best when they're big, when they're huge. They can't be big enough. ERCOT is big. That's the Texas system. But the Eastern Interconnect is substantially bigger. That's the system we live within. And bigness means you have a diversity of assets, which means different generation types. You might even have electricity coming from different climate zones to protect you against the possibility that you freeze and somebody else doesn't. So what we need to do, especially as we move toward more and more intermittent renewable energy that we can't predict as well as we can predict the output of thermal power plants, is keep adding to that resiliency. Never forget that we're exposed to risks from sun shining and not shining, risks to demand. And also, I think that as the federal government needs to look at this very seriously, and we need to change. We need to introduce much more long range transmission into our system. That's the electricity that carries power long distances between generating sites that may be very far away and distribution centers. We have a very arcane system for managing and permitting transmission lines in this country that prevents long lines from being built. And that creates a risk of its own. It also creates cost within the system because it will drive us with expanded renewable use to have more battery storage and a lot more redundant generation. So I hope that's an area where we can really make some progress in the next several years.
Well, I want to thank you both for educating us today. It was really helpful to have you. We just heard Robert Deputy Director of the MIT Energy Initiative, and Dan Dolan, President of the New England Power Grid Association. Thanks to both of you for being on Radio Boston today.